Imagine you're a deep sea welder. It's 4 a.m., you're sleeping peacefully in your bunk when you're suddenly woken up by a ringing telephone. You answer it in a daze, and it's your boss screaming at you to come to the deck immediately and bring a blowtorch. Some kind of problem with the decompression chamber. So you rush out of the room, grab your acetylene torch, and head to the deck where you find crew members rushing around panicked everywhere. You look off to one side and you see a crew member named Billy laid out on the deck, motionless. He's flanked by two personnel doing CPR. And in the other direction, you see another crew member named Martin. He's writhing on the ground in agony as a medic tightens a tourniquet on his leg. But before you can figure out what happened to them, you hear the sound of your boss screaming at you from the side of the decompression chamber. A hatch needs to be cut open immediately. So you run over there, your heart pounding in your chest, and you realize as you get closer that there's a giant smudge around the hatch. In fact, it's blood. Lots of blood. Your foot slips as you're running, and you look back to see that you stepped on something that kind of looks like a slab of bacon. In fact, you have to slow down because your feet are sliding everywhere. The whole surface seems to be covered in some kind of grease and other stuff. Finally, you reach the stuck hatch, and you light the torch to cut it open, but as you turn to the hatch, you see that it's stuck, but just slightly open, maybe a 5-inch crack in the door. And you glance inside the crack as you start to cut, and you lay eyes on one of the most horrific workplace accidents of all time. An event so disturbing, people will still be talking about it 40 years later. That oil rig was the Byford Dolphin. They say when you go in the ocean, you re-enter the food chain. It's a foreign environment, one we're not adapted to or designed for, and that's more true the further down you go as the weight of the water puts crushing pressure on the body. But sometimes we gotta go down there. Our modern world has a surprisingly extensive undersea infrastructure. From offshore gas drilling to windmills to oil pipelines, undersea cables, there's a lot of stuff at the bottom of the sea that we all rely on, and all of that needs to be maintained. In fact, it's especially vulnerable to the elements because it's in the ocean. But that maintenance has to be done by people. People who take on a special risk by going down there. Think about how hard this job is. You're doing construction work, like welding, bolting, cutting, the kind of stuff that would be a tough job on land, but you're doing it in the water, in basically a spacesuit, at depths too low for the sun to reach, so you're in total darkness. You're dragging massive cables along behind you the entire time, and the seafloor is constantly swirling dirt and mud around you, so visibility is less than zero sometimes. But on top of all of that, maybe the craziest thing about this job is that you have to live in a tiny chamber for 28 days while you're doing all that. It's a process known as saturation diving. So you've all heard of the bends, right? It's that condition that divers can get if they ascend too quickly. Well, imagine if instead of going down 20 or 30 feet, you're going down 600 feet or even 2,000 feet. Like, how long would it take to decompress every time you came to the surface? Actually, you don't have to guess. I can tell you. It's a day for every 100 feet of depth. So, yeah, it's 600 feet. You'd need 6 days to compress and decompress, according to the internet, anyway. So you can think of it like a bottle of soda, right? So CO2 is added at high pressure, and it causes that to saturate into the water. Just like being underwater at high pressure causes gases to saturate into your blood. It's the same idea. But if you just release the pressure, then all those gases would come out of your blood. Bubbles would just form in your blood vessels. It would not be good. The trick is to turn the cap slowly, like really slowly, slow enough that bubbles just kind of don't form. The gas just sort of easily comes out of the solution. So if you're working down at the bottom of the ocean under those extreme pressures and you've got to go through a long decompression process every single time you come to the surface, a long and dangerous decompression process for that matter, that's a lot of wasted time and a lot of extra risk you're taking on. Unless you just stay pressurized. That's why saturation divers have to live in these tiny decompression chambers for weeks at a time, often up to 28 days. The way it's usually done is there's a pressure chamber on the surface vessel that the crew lives in for, again, up to about 28 days. They take turns working 8-hour shifts down at the sea floor, which they ride down to in a diving bell, kind of like an underwater elevator. After their shift is over, they go back up in the diving bell, dock the diving bell to the pressurized living quarters, and then do what they call a TUP, or a transfer under pressure, into the living quarters. Once that's sealed, the crew can then detach the diving bell for servicing. Although in some cases they do just kind of stay at the bottom of the ocean in a deep sea habitat. Okay, so just to put this pressure in perspective, think about how your ears pop when you're ascending or descending on a plane. So they pressurize planes to be at about the same as 8,000 feet of elevation. That's about 0.74 atmospheres. So that difference that you're feeling is between one atmosphere and 0.74 atmosphere. It's literally a quarter of an atmosphere difference. Saturation divers go from one atmosphere up to 19 atmospheres, some even higher than that. The deepest saturation dive was done in 1992 by a company that was kind of researching the limits of this. They sent a diver to 2,300 feet of depth. That equaled 71.1 atmospheres of pressure. This is still the deepest saturation dive of all time and the most pressure any human being has ever experienced. Oh, by the way, the air that they breathe in those tanks, it's not just oxygen. It's actually what they call trimix. It's a mixture of oxygen, nitrogen, and helium. Helium because it's inert, so it doesn't react to anything. And it's also very low density, which makes it easier to breathe under pressure. But being that it's helium, it does have the expected side effects of breathing helium. That, combined with the fact that sound just kind of works differently under higher pressures, means that these people, some of the most badass construction workers on the planet, people doing construction work on the bottom of the ocean, are talking back and forth to each other, sounding like this.
Hello, hello. Well, it's the 19th of December.
Anyway, I hope that gave you a smile, because the rest of this video is horrifying. The Biford Dolphin was drilling in a gas field in the North Sea on November 5th, 1983. There were four divers total, including two British divers, Edwin Arthur Coward and Roy P. Lucas, and two Norwegian divers, Bjorn Bergesen and Truls Hillevik. The depth that they were diving required that they be pressurized to 9 atmospheres, and they worked in shifts, with the British crew going down together while the Norwegians rested, and then vice versa. In the early morning hours of November 5th, Coward and Lucas were resting in their sleeping chamber, which in diagrams is chamber 2. Bergesen and Hillevik had just come back up to the decompression chamber after finishing their 8-hour shift, which actually ran a few hours over. Once at the surface, they docked the diving bell to the decompression chamber with the help of two dive tenders, William Crammond and Martin Saunders. The way it works is that they dock to a trunk that kind of sticks out from the pressure chamber. It's kind of like an airlock in space terms. But once that connection is sealed, the trunk is then pressurized to 9 atmospheres. Then the crew can crawl across the tunnel. This is that transfer under pressure that I was talking about. They open the hatch to get into the pressure chamber, climb in, reseal the hatch, and then the dive tenders depressurize the trunk and detach the diving bell. Now, this was something that they did all the time, day after day. But on this particular day, something went wrong. What exactly happened has never been fully understood, though one of the crew did get the brunt of the blame, possibly unfairly. I'll get to that in a minute. Some say it may have been a communication issue because of the stormy conditions that day, but basically what happened is this. Bergesen had entered the chamber first and stood on the opposite side of the chamber while Hillevik was in the process of closing the hatch. But just before the hatch was fully closed, one of the dive tenders opened the clamp to free the tunnel from the diving bell. Again, we don't know if it was a communication issue or a mistake brought about by tiredness and fatigue, but when that clamp was loosened, the pressure shot out of that chamber. Just in case you're wondering how powerful 9 atmospheres of pressure can be, the diving bell weighed 80,000 pounds. This sent it flying across the platform. That diving bell smashed into Crammond and Saunders with the force of a semi-truck at full speed. Crammond held on long enough for the helicopter to rescue him and pick him up, but he died on the way to the hospital. Saunders managed to survive, but suffered multiple extensive injuries, including a broken back and a broken neck. He was actually the only survivor of the Biford Dolphin incident, because the four guys inside the chambers... Well, this is where things get really grisly. I would give you a content warning and ask you to skip ahead, but let's be honest, if you clicked on this video, this is the part that you came here for. Freaks. Coward, Lucas, and Bergesen just dropped dead. Actually, Bergesen dropped dead because he was standing when it happened. Coward and Lucas were actually in their beds, probably asleep, so they just died. That's what it looked like from the outside, anyway. They just stopped breathing and maybe got a little puffy. Because instantaneously, nitrogen and other gases just surged out of their blood and tissues like a Mentos and Diet Coke. Their blood literally boiled inside of them. In less than a second, there were bubbles filling every inch of their bodies. Blood circulation obviously was impossible, and their bodies just stopped functioning. Like, if you want to try to imagine what that would be like, you might think it would be like suffocating because no blood can get to your brain. Like, you might have a brief moment of panic as you become conscious of what's happening. But here's the thing. Their brains were boiling too. So they weren't aware of anything. It was just over. The autopsy report talked about how this degassing of their blood also kind of solidified lipids and fats in their bodies. And they explain it like this. Quote, in the cardiac chambers and the great vessels around the heart, both arteries and veins, large amounts of free fats were found. This fat was mixed with gas bubbles and looked like sizzling butter in a frying pan. That's horrible. But as horrible as that sounds, it's what happened to the fourth diver that's made the Biford Dolphin incident so memorable. Yeah, as I was saying before, Hillevik was in the process of closing the hatch when this decompression happened. The hatch itself is 60 centimeters, or about 2 feet in diameter. But it was most of the way closed when it happened, leaving about a 5-inch gap. A 5-inch gap that Hillevik was standing right in front of. So remember how I was saying that the force was strong enough to throw an 80,000-pound steel diving bell like it's a rag doll? Well, there was that much force, then there was Hillevik, and then there was a 5-inch gap. It literally fired him out of the decompression chamber like a cannon. And he didn't go through smoothly either. To get much more grotesque, his body basically was pushed up against that gap in the door, which was right in front of his abdomen. And the pressure then pushed through his body, sending his abdominal organs flying through the hole. And then the rest of his body folded in half backwards and just got shredded through there. Only everything that I just said happened in a span of microseconds. From an outside perspective, there was just an explosion of body parts that covered the deck of the platform. One body part that they couldn't even figure out what it was found 10 feet above the decompression chamber. It took 4 body bags to collect all of his remains, and the investigators still didn't think they got all of it. Now, you might be noticing that I'm not using any actual pictures of the event in this video, and no, I'm not, for all the obvious reasons, but I did use the autopsy report as a source. It is linked below. It's just as brutal as you think, so it is not for the squeamish. No, it literally just like, it literally flayed him apart. And because of the way his body folded, it kind of defleshed him. So yeah, there were like large chunks of skin laying around, including his face. It literally just ripped his face clean off. So it's easy to see why this accident has sort of imprinted itself on our collective psyches. It's gory, it's sensational. But for me, I don't know, man, it just hits that existential dread place for me, you know? Like the idea that 1 second you're there and then 1 second you're everywhere. Like, we don't think of our bodies as something that can just like instantly disintegrate like that. Like did he even have time to know that something had gone wrong? Or was it just lights out? I don't know. Some people might say that's the best way to go, just immediate nothingness. But for me, I don't like thinking about this. Somebody paid for this, right? Well, I mentioned earlier that one of the divers took most of the blame for it. That diver was Billy Crammond. So yeah, Crammond is one of the dive tenders that was helping to secure the diving bell to the chamber as the crew performed their TUP. And he was the one that pulled the clamp before the chamber hatch had fully closed, which is a mistake he paid for with his life. So when the families and the governments and the companies behind it were looking for answers for what happened, it was pretty easy for them to just point the finger at him. The company behind it, by the way, was Comex. They were the ones that were operating the Biford Dolphin, and it was in the jurisdiction of the Norwegian government. It was part of their sea area. But yeah, most of the blame landed on Crammond, and in fact, so much hate was directed at Crammond that his widow, Ruth Crammond, had to move away from her home in Edinburgh. And of course, it's not that cut and dried. Obviously, the company wanted to wash their hands of the whole thing, and the easiest way to do that was just to direct all the blame at Crammond, because, you know, to take responsibility would cost them a lot of money.
I am never going to financially recover from this.
But the reality is the company did make decisions that contributed to this accident, and those decisions were also all about the money. Because it turns out that this kind of accident was 100% preventable by a simple interlocking mechanism that keeps the clamp from releasing until the hatch is closed. And this wasn't some like fancy newfangled technology. In fact, regulations had been passed in 1982 that made these mandatory on saturation dive rigs, but it only applied to new construction projects. The Biford Dolphin was kind of grandfathered in. So they didn't have to install it, but they could have, and they chose not to. At the same time, they were pushing these divers on longer and longer shifts. Industry standard was about 8-hour shifts, but Comex actually lobbied the Norwegian government to allow for longer shifts. This means the divers were working for as long as 14 to 18 hours at a time. So, yeah, I mean, of course they were exhausted and out of their minds at 4 a.m. in a roiling sea. It's almost like working people way past when it's safe is unsafe. But perhaps the real victims of all of this were the families of the 6 men involved. The Norwegian government did pay some compensation to the families of Bergersen and Hillevik because they were Norwegian citizens. Saunders was granted a disability benefits through the UK, though I'm sure it didn't come close to replacing his income. It was the Coward, Lucas, and Crammond families that suffered the most. They were denied compensation from the company and the Norwegian government until 2009, when the North Sea Divers Alliance brought a lawsuit over the accident. That means their widows raised their children alone for 25 years on just a fraction of what they were expecting to live on. They finally did settle that 2009 lawsuit for an undisclosed amount. The money won't bring back what they lost, obviously, but at least the organizations involved finally took some responsibility. And, yeah, Ruth Cramman was able to finally move back to Edinburgh with some measure of vindication. And thankfully, regulations are much tighter in the diving industry today, partly because of the Byford Dolphin incident. I guess if there's an upside to horrifying accidents, it's that they can actually lead to actual positive change because we're all just so horrified by it. The North Sea is now considered one of the safest places for divers, but no place is completely safe. Like, even with modern technology, deaths of commercial deep-sea divers are still reported every year. One of the most horrifying recent events happened in 2022 when five underwater welders were sucked into an oil pipe off the coast of Trinidad. Yeah, the last man that got sucked into the pipe did manage to survive, but he was the only survivor. The deaths of the other men have been blamed on criminal negligence by the fuel company. All of which might make you wonder why somebody would ever sign up to do a job so dangerous, but the answer is pretty simple. Saturation divers are some of the highest paid construction jobs in the world. And rightfully so. Yet the British divers who were on the Byford Dolphin were making £2,000 per month. That's the equivalent of £14,000 today. Although they use euros now, so. But you want to hear what's really crazy? The number of commercial diving deaths is nowhere near the number of deaths from recreational diving. So 2018 is the last year that we have solid numbers for, and there were 55 recreational diving fatalities in the United States and Canada alone, 189 worldwide. The number of commercial diving fatalities in 2018? 6. At least the commercial divers are getting paid well. The recreational divers died just doing it for free. And most of them were in submerged caves. I will never understand why people go cave diving. Although, to be fair, there are a lot more recreational divers than commercial saturation divers. Even if it does pay a lot of money, it's still one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. According to the North Sea Divers Alliance, between 1965 and 1990, there were 350 to 400 working saturation divers in the entire world. Out of that count, 56 of them died. That's a 1 in 7 ratio. But that's a risk that saturation divers are willing to take. Because the pay is good, sure, yeah, of course, but it's also important, challenging work, and some people love that kind of challenge, you know? It gives them a purpose. It takes a certain type of person to do this. I mean, these guys give off big astronaut energy. Yeah, Ruth Cramman said that she would complain to her husband about how dangerous his job was, and he would just kind of shrug it off and say that crossing the road is dangerous. For the record, he's not wrong. Looking at those 2018 numbers, there were 189 diving deaths and 6,000 people who died crossing the road. It would be kind of ironic if one of those deaths was a saturation diver on his day off. I mean, they're not used to having traffic on the bottom of the ocean. And maybe someday we won't have to put people's lives on the line anymore. I did a video a while back about humanoid robots. Well, there's underwater robots as well. Like, we already have to tether people to the surface for air and communications. Robots could do the same thing and be down there for as long as they need to be. No decompression necessary. A couple of early steps in that direction include the U-1 from U-Wear Robotics. It's designed to not just swim through the water, but to hover in place, which is actually kind of difficult, and it's very necessary if you're going to do some work with it. Right now, it's mostly used for scanning the seafloor and not so much for physical labor. For that, you might want to look at the Aquanaut from Nauticus Robotics. It actually has articulating arms and robotic claws that can be controlled remotely or be pre-programmed for a number of tasks. These have a very long way to go before they start taking any sat diving jobs, but they are a step in that direction, for better or for worse. Until that happens, some of the bravest, maybe craziest roughnecks on the planet will continue to do the important work that they do under pressure. I have held off on making that joke this entire video, and those same men will be just a little bit safer because of the Byford Dolphin incident. So I guess if you want to find a silver lining in a story about four guys spontaneously exploding, there you go. Of course, there might be fewer of these jobs going around. I just read that OPEC has reported that global oil demand has slowed from 2.11 million barrels a day to 2.03 million barrels a day. I tend to think that's a good thing because we need to be getting off of oil, but of course somebody else might think that's bad for the economy. And because of that, you know, different news sources might report that differently. So let's talk about ground news. Ground news, if you haven't heard of it, it is what I honestly think all news should be today. Like, if I could just do a Thanos snap and then every news organization in the world does one thing, it would be for it to operate the way ground news does. What Ground News does is they aggregate news stories from all around the world, from major news companies to small regional newspapers, and they have a little bias chart, so you can see exactly which way each news source leans politically. Oh, by the way, they also show who owns the news agencies, so you can see exactly what agenda they might have if you're a, you know, follow-the-money type. So going back to the story that I was talking about earlier, you can see how this works. So there's 38 articles that they list here in their little aggregator, but when you go down, not only do you see where the article came from, you see how they lean politically. Here's one that leans left, here's one that leans right. You have a mixed factuality and high factuality. So again, these are based off of independent reporting and people who are watchdogs on this kind of thing. And over here on the right, you can see a bias distribution. So you can kind of see where these articles kind of fall on the spectrum. And one of my favorite things is it actually shows you who owns the source that you're looking at. So right here, it's by the Murdoch family. Bloomberg, obviously, is owned by Michael Bloomberg, but it's also by a private equity firm. So if you ever wonder, like, who is putting this information out there, this actually shows you that.
Look, our news landscape is fractured and it is polarized. And if you don't make an effort to diversify your news intake, which most people don't because they're just living their lives here, you can wind up with a very skewed perspective on the world. But Ground News makes it easy because it's right there as you're browsing. Every single story that comes up, it will tell you where the bias is. Or, look, if you only want to hear one side of a particular issue, then you can search the topic and they'll show you a list of articles with their biases and you can read the one that you want to read. But at least you know you're reading something biased. And every once in a while, maybe you'll go check out the other side, see what they're saying. Like, I don't know if you noticed this, but it's an election year. And it's borderline funny to me how different the reporting is between, say, like NPR and Fox News. It's just, they're completely different realities. Which, by the way, if you do have a little bit of a blind spot, they have an actual blind spot feature where you can see stories that are exclusively being covered by one side or the other. Anyway, Ground News has legitimately become the place that I go to when something happens and I want to be informed about it because I know what I'm getting and I know how much I can trust it.
It really is an amazing tool. I recommend it for free in real life. But for you fine viewers out there, if you go to ground.news/Joe Scott, you can get 40% off their Vantage subscription.
Or, as a saturation diver might say,
go to ground.news/Joe Scott to get 40% off their Vantage plan.
Anyway, check out Ground News and get more information about your information. Links down below. All right, thank you so much for watching. If this is your first time here, maybe check out this video because Google thinks that it'll be right up your alley. Or if you're watching on your browser, there might be a bunch of videos over here on the side. You can go click on those. And yeah, if you enjoy them, I invite you to subscribe. Come back with videos every Monday. Big extra thanks to the Patreon supporters and channel members who are financially supporting this channel and helping to keep the lights on. Also, just forming an awesome community. If you would like to join them, get early access to videos and all kinds of cool stuff. Access to Discord, early release, all that kind of cool stuff. You can just go to patreon.com/answerswithjoe or click the Join Now button down below this video. And as always, there's extra content over on Nebula if you want to go there. You can also see it ad-free. But that's it for now. You guys go out there, have an eye-opening rest of the week. Stay safe. I'll see you next Monday. Love you guys. Take care.